Bill Lewis and I are the same age. There's 2 months difference between us. We not only share that in common, but we have a granddaughter in common, too. His daughter, Julie, is the wife of our son, Nathan. Bill and I have discussed a lot of things, especially the scriptures. The world into which Bill and I were born doesn't exist anymore. The world into which most of you, including Ed Johnson, a fellow as young as he, doesn't exist anymore. I miss that world. When I was a child, my father used to tell me, and I've heard this over and over, and this is ingrained in my consciousness. I thought my father lived by cliches. If I heard it once, I heard it 1,000 times from his lips. Right's right and wrong's wrong. Now, I got tired of hearing that as a child. But my dad was right. He was absolutely right. At that time, my dad wasn't a Christian. He was that youth minister I wrote about and Dub published in the Gospel Journal. My dad later became a Christian. He wasn't at that time. But he knew what was right and what was wrong. And most people did in those days. But those days are gone. And now we live in a day where everything is relative. Everything is, it depends upon the situation. And that's our subject for now. Situation ethics. What does that mean? Well, actually, situation ethics is one single approach to ethical questions, to moral questions. And situation ethics is one of two approaches that are as old as the race of man. And the first approach is that of subjectivism. Webster says subjectivism is the doctrine that good or the supreme good is the realization of some type of subjective experience or feeling as pleasure. The doctrine that the individual feeling, now listen to this, the doctrine that the individual feeling or apprehension is the ultimate criterion of good and right. What does that mean? Oh, we have... Solomon said there's no new thing under the sun. And he was right. All this stuff is, we just dress old heresies and old wickedness up in new clothes. What does that mean? That the subjective feeling is the apprehension is the ultimate criterion of good and right. Means what I think is right is right. It's what now we call postmodernism. It's what I think is right is right. I think I can do what BJ was talking about. I can look upon a woman and to lust after her, and that's all right. Now, if BJ thinks he can't, that's all right for him. See, that's truth for him. This is all relative. That's what subjectivism is. That's the philosophy that is built upon and behind that old mantra of the 60s, if it feels good, do it. That's what it means. Or it is forbidden to forbid, or that old denominational doctrine that I've heard all of my life, you go your way and we'll go ours and we'll all get to the same place together. Or you join the church of your choice. See how relative that is? Your choice, my choice. We leave the Lord out. He has no choice, see. Situation ethics, subjectivism, says whatever I think is right. It applies, or as applied, to the moral and the ethical realms, a subjectivist approach makes the individual's consciousness the ultimate standard. Whatever I think is right. my personal feelings. That's the sole authority in any given ethical case. Now, the other approach to ethics, we looked at subjectivism. The other approach is objectivism. Webster says that is any of certain theories stressing the objective reality, especially as distinguished from the purely subjective experience or existence of the phenomenal world of moral good or the lack. Now, this view represents the opposite of that subjective view that says whatever I think is fine. In that, objectivism recognizes a moral, ethical standard of living that is totally outside of what I think or who I am. What is that standard? That standard is God. Remove God from the equation and you have no objective standard. Take God out of the picture, which is exactly what humanism's trying to do, and you have no objective standard. I once knew a girl, I worked with her, who claimed to be an atheist. And we were watching television one day, and there was somebody on there who was convicted of murder, a heinous murder, and she said, "Oh, that person, I hope he gets the chair or whatever." I said, "Why?" "Well, if there's no God, there's no problem with him murdering somebody." And she started stuttering and stammering, and don't think she ever did answer me. But that's true. Take God out and you have no standard. We're all a bunch of animals. The objectivist sees moral conduct as being regulated by higher law. We know that. And that law is higher than ourselves. The objectivist acknowledges God as the ruler of the moral realm and understands that God's law is the law by which I must live. Not what I think. What I think is situation ethics. The Bible contains God's absolute law. And the objectivist views his conduct in the light of the Bible without considering the mores of our culture. I get so sick of hearing these so-called brethren, and most of them I don't consider brethren, who want to say, "Well, we have to change the church. It has to conform to our culture." Or as Reuben Shelley said, "If the church doesn't change, my kids are not going to be in it." That's his kid's problem. That's his problem. God is unchanging and unchangeable. Doesn't make any difference what I think or what the culture thinks or what the culture does. If we live by the culture, well, look at what Tyler and BJ have already been talking about. Abortion, pornography, filth. Is that going to be our standard? It is if we're going to live by situation ethics. Situation ethics is simply a modern dressed-up term for that ages-old philosophy of subjectivism, which makes man a law unto himself and disregards the moral law of God. That's all situation ethics is. It's nothing new. It's just that philosophy that says whatever I think is right. Oh, you think something else? Well, then that's right for you. But there is no objective standard. I don't think there is anybody in our government or anywhere else that would really want to live by that sort of philosophy in our civil government. Although I could be wrong about that. Our conduct, whether it's right or wrong before God, is not dependent upon the circumstances in which we exist or in which we live. But it is contingent upon what the absolute, objective, moral law of God says. The classic expression of subjectivism. And understand, I'm going to use that term subjectivism synonymously with situation ethics, because it's the same thing. And the subjectivist is the situation ethicist. The classic expression of subjectivism was published by Joseph Fletcher in the 1970s in his book entitled Situation Ethics. Here's what Fletcher said about the concept of God's universal moral law. Quote, "How shall we respond to the question whether extramarital sex is wrong? Or even paid sex? Women have done it to feed their families, to pay debts, to serve their countries and counter espionage, to honor a man whom they could not marry. Are we entitled to say that depending on the situation, those who break the seventh commandment of the old law, even whores, could be doing a good thing? If it is for love's sake, for the neighbor's sake? In short, is there any real law of universal weight? The situationist thinks not." End quote. That's page 146 of Fletcher's book. This then indicates what the situationist or the subjectivist thinks of a universal moral code for the human race. He says there's none. There's none. Let me tell you what's scary. And this is why the things that Tyler addressed, the things that BJ addressed, the things that Dubs and others on this lectureship are going to. The reason those are such problems today is because of situation ethics. That's the philosophy that drives our society anymore. That's why you cannot judge, and those people will judge you if you start judging. They'll judge that you're judging. There's no objective standard, so you can't judge, they say. Well, for the last four decades, and probably longer, but at least for the last four decades, situation ethics has been a leading philosophy of people in our country. From Lyndon Johnson, who considered himself a pragmatic politician. That's what he called himself. You know what pragmatism is? It's what works. Whatever works. Basically, it's the end justifies the means. Whatever works. That's situation ethics. From Lyndon Johnson, who was described himself as a pragmatic politician, and this is in the highest offices of our land, from him to Bill Clinton, who redefined sexual relations to fit his own depraved moral conduct. It is a philosophy that has led to the current practice of calling evil good and calling good evil, particularly in the realm of the practice of sodomy in this country. And as someone pointed out, there's not any more sodomy practice today than there was when Bill Lewis and I were kids. That's a long time ago. What's the difference? They're out in the open. They have the approval of the highest officials of the land and the Supreme Courts in states like Vermont and Massachusetts. And let me tell you, Tyler, them are Yankee states. Those Supreme Courts in those states who approve that sort of perversion, that is calling evil good and good evil. We live in a topsy-turvy world. Our world's upside down. And as I said, it's not the world I was born into. I miss that world. I miss Roy Rogers and Gene Autry and Lash LaRue and Whip Wilson. And I miss the absolute moral standard that even in those days, even denominational people lived by. My grandfather Brewer was a Methodist preacher. Now, I never knew him because he died in 1919. But the story is told that he would not even wear a shirt that my grandmother ironed for him on Sunday because he said it was ironed on the Sabbath. Well, you couldn't get a Methodist preacher today to be that strict. That's a different world. Fletcher says, for the situationist, there are no rules. There are no rules at all. Now, that's on page 55. Situation ethics tosses out all rules of any kind of moral conduct, so it makes every man a law unto himself. Whatever I deem as good and right and in the best interest, perhaps, of the most people would be all right. That leads to the inevitable conclusion that Adolf Hitler was not an immoral person. Did you know that? Situation ethics says Adolf Hitler was not an immoral person. We all know Hitler killed several million Jews. And not only Jews, but Slavs, Russians, others. It wasn't just the Jews who were murdered by him, his thugs. Why? Because he was a situationist. He was a subjectivist. He was doing what he thought was good for the German nation. Why? You young people need a lesson in history. Hitler didn't just hate Jews without a cause. He had a reason. He thought they were responsible for Germany's defeat in World War I. He considered Jews an incubus in society. And when he came to power in the early 1930s, he was determined to eradicate that threat and eradicate and cleanse German society. He was doing what was best for the German people, and they loved it. Now, there's situation ethics. Who could condemn Jim Jones and his Kool-Aid cohorts in Guyana? That's situation ethics. He did what he thought was best. Someone says, well, I think it's terrible. Well, that's just what you think. Who says it's terrible? If there is no God, if there is no moral standard that is objective and absolute and apart from my consciousness, who can say that was wrong? Joseph Stalin enslaved and murdered millions of people during the years that he ruled the Soviet Union. But he wasn't an immoral person. He couldn't be called that according to situation ethics. Same goes for Charles Manson in California. The same for Mao Zedong in China. Their murderous and evil reigns of terror demonstrate the ultimate fruit of situation ethics. One of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century, and I spent a lot more time there than I will in this one, I expect. One of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century was not Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin's enslavement and murder of millions of people. You know what the greatest tragedy of that century was? Was the embrace of situation ethics that led to what they did. The idea that there is no absolute objective moral law. To Fletcher and to all subjectivists who adhere, those of us who adhere to an absolute moral law are called what? Legalists. Legalists. What's not wrong to be a legalist? Now, what they mean is we're Pharisaical legalists. We're the Pharisees. You people want to hold to an absolute law? Why, you're a bunch of Pharisees, a bunch of old legalists. What's not wrong to be a legalist? To those people, though, legalism is nothing more than adherence to God's immutable moral law. And by calling us legalists, they mean to say we're Pharisees. To the situationist, to the subjectivist, God's moral law is nothing more than tradition. That's all it is. So, well, you people are just traditionalists. Well, Jesus did condemn the binding of human tradition. Did you know that? In Matthew 15, they came to him in Matthew 15:2, and they said, "Why do thy disciples transgress the tradition of the elders, for they wash not their hands when they eat bread?" Your disciples are transgressing the tradition of the elders because they don't wash their hands. Jesus answered them, turned their question back on them, said, "Why do you transgress the commandment of God by your tradition?" And then he says in Matthew 15:9, "But in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." They're teaching for their doctrines, their traditions, or their commandments. But the New Testament reveals that God's tradition is to be observed. Traditions that come from God are to be observed. Listen to Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. "Therefore, brethren," chapter 2, verse 15, "stand fast in the traditions and hold the traditions which you've been taught, whether by word, our word, or our epistle." Now, the tradition there, he's talking about the commands of God. Some traditions that are bad, human tradition, but when that word tradition is applied to the commands of God, nothing wrong with it. Those who equate human tradition with the tradition of God, that man is himself a traditionalist, because he elevates human tradition, situation ethics, above the commands of God. Let me tell you this. The man who practices situation ethics is the Pharisee. He has his own idea, his own notion of what is right and wrong, and he will bind that upon himself and upon others. He is the Pharisee, not the man who holds to God's absolute law, but the man who holds to his own tradition, makes his own traditions, situation ethics, a standard of human conduct rather than God's law. There's a vast difference between keeping God's commandments and Pharisaical legalism. Jesus never condemned the Pharisees for keeping the law of Moses. Did you know that? It was never a condemnation of the Pharisees for keeping the law of Moses. Jesus told his disciples, in fact, to do the bidding of the Pharisees when they instructed them in the law. He says, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore, whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do." Why? They sit in Moses' seat. They're teaching the law. "But do not ye after their works, for they say and do not." They're hypocrites. The entire thrust of Matthew 23 is a condemnation of the hypocrisy of the Pharisees who twisted the law of Moses to fit their own notions. And in so doing, they formed their own standard by which to measure themselves. They were situationists. The Pharisees practiced situation ethics. They practiced situation religion, just like most of the denominational world does today. They were the situationists. They twisted the law of God. They set their own standard. They measured themselves by that standard which they themselves set. They pretended to be righteous according to God's law while living up to not His law, but their own standard. God's standard of righteousness is the gospel. "I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith unto faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith." Romans 1:16-17. In the gospel is revealed what, Paul? God's righteousness. You mean that God's a righteous being? Oh, no. That was known way back in the Old Testament. The gospel didn't come to reveal that God is a righteous being or to reveal His righteous attributes. reveals His standard for making men right before Him. In the gospel is God's standard for making men right. Pharisees knew God was righteous, but they didn't live up to His standard. That this refers to God's standard for making men righteous is seen from Romans 10, beginning verse 1, where Paul says, "Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved, for I bear them record that they have a knowledge of God, but not according, or they have a zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness, and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves to the righteousness of God." Now, they were ignorant that God was a righteous being? No. They were ignorant of God's righteousness, His standard. And so what did they do? They set up their own. That's what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, and that's what He meant when He said, "Except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you can't enter into the kingdom of heaven." Years ago, when I was a young preacher, I used to think that what Jesus was saying there was that the Pharisees gave 10%, y'all are going to have to do more. They gave 10%, you ought to give 11 or 12, or you have to exceed theirs. That's not what He's talking about. He says, Paul said, "They, being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own," that is their own standard, "did not submit to God's righteousness." That's what Jesus meant in the Sermon on the Mount, except you are made righteous by a higher standard, God's righteousness, an objective standard, than the scribes and Pharisees. You can't enter into the kingdom of heaven. Situationists, the legalists, the Pharisaical legalists are the situationists, and they elevate their own traditions above God's law. Today's practitioner of situation ethics is a modern-day Pharisee. He is the Pharisee, not the one who holds to God's absolute law. The situationist maintains that man is not governed by law, but by love. Let me tell you, there is not a whit's worth of difference between the situation ethicist and the change agents in the church. There is not a bit of difference between that philosophy of morality which says, do your own thing, that we ought to submit to love and not law, and those in the church who say, well, we ought to just love one another. Love is the standard of our fellowship. That ain't so. What they're trying to do is pit love against law, as though those two are mutually exclusive. Same tactic is used by the situationist that's used by those who want to pit God's grace against the faith of man, or against the obedience of man. Grace and obedience, they think, are mutually exclusive. God's grace does not negate His law, and His law does not negate His love. God loves all men. John 3:16. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. People say, well, there you go. God loved the world. Nothing for us to do. So we just get a warm feeling for everybody like God has, and everything be all right. You know, I get a warm feeling for those I like. You remember the movie Shenandoah with Jimmy Stewart? Back when movies were half decent. And his son was going to get married, and he said, why? He said, well, I love her. And he said, yes, but do you like her? Do you like her? There's a difference between love and like. God did not like the world. People think, oh, well, if I start liking them, then I'll learn to love them. God did not like the world. If he had, he wouldn't have sent his son to die for us. But he loved us, and he still loves us. And he loves us enough to give us instructions on how to live. That's his law. Those instructions are for our good. The situationist pits law against love and makes it an either-or situation. It's either law or it's love, but it can't be both. But that assumption that God has given laws of conduct that may be cast aside in some situations is to maintain that God has not expressed his love in his laws. But he has. God's laws are not arbitrary. God's laws are for our good. For our good. Why did he give the law that there should be one man for one woman? And Jesus said from the beginning. It's always been that way. God's moral law has never changed. Let me tell you this. When Jesus Christ came into the world to die for our sins, to fulfill all the Old Testament prophecies, to redeem fallen man, Jesus did not bring into this world, the gospel did not bring into this world one single new moral concept. People say, well, if I be good, I can be a Christian. You ought to be good because you're a Christian, but being good don't make you a Christian. God's moral law has been here from the beginning. It is as true today as it was in Noah's day when God said, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For he was made in the image of God. God's moral law, his law against murder, law against adultery, fornication, anything you can think of, hasn't changed. Same today as it was then. Jesus didn't bring any new moral law. He came into the world to save men from their sins. Man has always had the capacity to be good morally throughout the history of the race. God's love is expressed in his laws and has always been. You can't array the love of God against the law of God and say that God's laws are not in man's best interest. Contrary to the situationist position, Jesus said, love does not dispense with law, but rather love, or God's law proves love, or the keeping of God's law proves love. Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Someone says, oh, I love the Lord, but I'm not into that rule-keeping. They call it rule-keeping. Well, call it what you want to. Call it rule-keeping, call it legalism, call it what you want to. God has a law that must be obeyed if we're to please him and live right in this world. And for our own best interest. That's what God's laws are for. You know, a situation ethics could ever be proven to be acceptable with God. There is an instance in the Old Testament. Now, I thought BJ was going to read this whole thing and preach a sermon on it. When he went to Genesis, the 39th chapter, situation with Joseph. Now, there is a situation. Look at Genesis 39. You know Joseph had been sold into slavery. He had been sold into servitude in the house of Potiphar, who was one of Pharaoh's officers. And that is interesting, that Potiphar's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph. Here's a young man. Joseph is a very young man. Don't know how old she was, but maybe a little older. But here's a young man. It says in Genesis 39, the last sentence of verse 6 says, Joseph was a goodly person and well favored. Verse 7 says, "And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph and said, lie with me." And Joseph thought within himself, no one is here. No one will know. We can have a good time. My master won't know. And this woman can give me pleasure and I can give her pleasure. No, that's not what that says, is it? It didn't say that. Listen, if there was ever a time for a man to practice situation ethics, if to show that God approved of it, right here's the time. She cast her eyes upon Joseph and said, come, lie with me. Joseph said, behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house. Wotteth means knoweth. He doesn't know. My master has turned everything over to me. He trusts me. And Joseph was highly favored and well trusted by Potiphar. He was the steward of Potiphar's house. He's the man that took care of everything. Potiphar had no idea what he... It's like, I don't want to be bothered with it. Joseph, you take care of it. He trusted the man. Joseph said, my master doesn't even know what is with me in the house. I could do what I wanted to. He hath committed all that he hath to my hand. Joseph could probably go and sign a check. Good nowadays. Just go and sign a check. Give whatever amount of money he wanted. There is none greater in this house than I. Well, next to Potiphar, Joseph was the greatest in the house, wasn't he? Neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. Now listen to this. Let this burn into your memory. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? He didn't say, I might be found out, or I might not be. He didn't say, the situation warrants this. What did Joseph say? I can't do it. Why, Joseph? Plenty of opportunity. Look at the situation. I can't do it. Why, Joseph? Because it's a sin against God. I don't care what my master's wife wants. I don't care what my master doesn't know. I know it, and God knows it. And God has told me not to do this, and I can't do this. Joseph was not a subjectivist. He recognized a greater law than his own feelings and thoughts and desires and want-tos and think-sos, and a higher law that transcended his own consciousness. Situation ethics is as old as the race of man. It's practiced in the Garden of Eden. There's that fruit. Well, yeah, I know what God has said, but that sure looks good. And this seems like the right thing to do. And it's good to make me wise. And it's good for food. So I think I'll eat it. Old is the race of man. That's what situation ethics is. Practiced by Nadab and Abihu. Oh, I know what God said about that fire from the altar. But look, doesn't this burn? I mean, what's the difference? This fire burns. Leviticus 10. Why, this fire burns, and look, it's burning the incense just like that other fire would. Sure. Situation ethics. Saul, go destroy Amalek and everything. Save the best of the flocks and the herds. Agag the king, 1 Samuel 15. Why'd you do that, Saul? Oh, I know what God said, but here's what Saul wanted to do. Situation ethics. David. B.J. alluded to David and talked about him, and that's an excellent lesson, excellent example. And I was telling him that I used that very same thing last Sunday in a sermon. Why did David murder a man? And the blood of Uriah was on David's hands. Why? Someone says, well, to keep him from finding out about his wife. Yeah. Why? Because she was with child. Yes. Why? Because she committed adultery with David. Yes. Why? Because David looked. If he had never looked. You see the progressive, deceptive, wicked nature of sin? If he had never looked upon Bathsheba, Uriah would never have died in that way. That's situation ethics. And that is as foreign to what is good and what is right as anything you could name upon this earth. Situation ethics is a brand of reasoning that is designed to eliminate all law and make each one of us a law unto himself, and to create spiritual and ethical anarchy. That's exactly what situation ethics does.